Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, depending upon where you are in the world. This is Walter Davis with Progress in the World radio show coming to you from beautiful Canyon Lake, California, just east of Los Angeles. And we have once again Reverend Fred Shaw on board. And we have a very exciting show today in which we're going to be covering racism in the psychiatric industry. And specifically, we're going to be talking about Jeffrey Lieberman. He's the former American Psychiatric Association president, and he was the chair of Columbia University Department of Psychiatry. He's been forced to resign due to putting out a tweet about a model from Africa. Her name is, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Nayakim Gotwet. My understanding is that she was born in Ethiopia and that her parents were from Sudan, and she ended up going into Buffalo, New York after leaving a refugee camp. And now she's become a multi-million dollar model. But due to the darkness of her skin, they called her the Queen of Darkness. And due to the darkness of her skin, the psychiatrist said that she was a freak of nature. So as a result of that tweet, he has been forced to resign his position. And he has a history of saying things, you know, that were inappropriate. So we're very lucky to have Reverend Shaw on board. And I believe I have my good friend Lauren Tinney in the chat room. I think she has called in. I have someone from 516 area code. I believe that is Lauren. Let me go ahead and bring her live right now.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Lauren? Lauren, is that you at 516?
Hi, yeah, this is Lauren Tenney. Hi.
Okay, hold on a second. I want to introduce Reverend Shaw, and then I will introduce you as well, okay? Okay, hold on. Reverend Shaw, thank you very much for, you know, being on board the show today, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and anytime I can come on your show, it is, you know, something I appreciate. I like the fact that you're willing to tackle the tough issues, so thank you for having me again.
And Lauren, can you tell the audience something about you?
Hi. Well, I'm really interested in learning about what your perspectives are on this. I'm a psychiatric survivor. I'm also a psychologist, a research psychologist, and have been trying to expose psychiatry's current racist and classist and gendered practices and root them back to the 19th century establishment of their field. So I'm really interested in hearing what you all are going to be saying today.
Well, excellent. So I'm going to leave the two of you unmuted. And I've done shows with you before, Lauren, so I know that you know what you're talking about. And Reverend Shaw, I just hope that, you know, we can interact and make this work. I'm sure that we can, and it's going to be great having another expert in the field of psychology on board. So briefly, I just want to go over some facts for people that you may not be aware of about the psychiatric industry. In 1792, Benjamin Rush, the father of American psychiatry, declared that African-American skin color derived from a disease called negritude, which he theorized was a form of leprosy. The cure was when their skin turned white. In 1950s, U.S. psychiatrist J.C. Carruthers argued that in many ways the African resembles a European 8 or 9 year old child in his reaction to the environment. He compared Africans to leucotomized Europeans. In 1960s, psychiatrists claimed civil rights protests caused violent schizophrenic symptoms in Negro populations, calling this protest psychosis. African-American men were said to have developed hostile and aggressive feelings and delusional anti-whiteness after listening to civil rights leaders. Ads for antipsychotics used African symbols to reflect so-called violent traits in blacks. 1990s, NIMH director, psychiatrist Frederick Goodwin, compared black youth to hyper-aggressive and hypersexual monkeys in a jungle who only want to kill one another, have sex, and reproduce. He was forced to resign. He helped develop a violence initiative program to look for a violent gene in African Americans and Hispanics that could be controlled by psychiatric drugs, including the antidepressant Prozac, known to cause violent and suicidal behavior. Also in the 1990s, as reported by the Black Chronicle, the New York State Psychiatric Institute has its own history of racial discrimination and questionable practices. The facility came under fire in 1998 after news broke of research involving black and Latino children targeted to test a theory about criminal or violent behavior and given a drug that was later pulled from the market. According to the New York Times, the researchers targeted boys 6 to 10 who were the younger brothers of people labeled at the time as delinquents. This is really astounding, right, Reverend Shaw?
Yes, it is. The history of psychiatry in the African-American community, it goes from what you started off talking about with Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was supposedly an abolitionist. I think he signed on the Declaration of Independence. He was the person who the American Psychiatric Association held on its seal up until a few years ago. But this is a man who, you know, like you mentioned, came up with the word negritude. And not only did it say the only way to know if you were cured or sane was if you turned white, it also promoted the separation of whites and blacks from each other, which is part of the problems that we're having with racism still to this day. It's affecting. And we see it in every aspect, be it education, where black children might be roughly 16% of the population, but 37% of the people diagnosed with a learning disability. We see law enforcement's reactions to African Americans based on coming out of some of the rhetoric that came out of psychiatry about African Americans being more violent and less intelligent. I've had black psychiatrists who graduated in the 60s and was participating in the 50s tell me, with them sitting in the class, the psychiatrist professors would talk about black people not being intelligent enough to respond to psychotype therapy, so therefore they have to be medicated and things like that. And this is what black psychiatrists are a student sitting in the classroom. So we have a long history of racism that comes out of psychiatry that comes before what we're looking at now with the process of law enforcement and some of those things that are being brought out. Psychiatry is even a greater offender than law enforcement. When you talk about young people in mental hospitals who are being choked to death and sat on until they can't breathe and things like that. This thing in the street about can't breathe was in mental hospitals long time ago where kids were being killed.
That is absolutely astounding. Of course, you know, I have a background in mental health myself, and I have approached psychologists, even black ones, and I talk to them. My specialty is addiction. And I talked to them about shame. The emotion of shame is the number one thing that people drink to medicate. You know, they drink alcohol and take other drugs to medicate shame. You know, in our culture, we don't talk about feelings. People say, I feel, then they give a thought. They don't necessarily say a feeling. And in fact, most people don't even know how they feel. They don't even know the difference between a thought and an emotion. And I remember this psychologist saying,
"I'm not hearing you."
Yeah, it went dead.
I'm sure, Walter, you'll come back in. And Reverend Shaw, what you're talking about is just so horrifying and true on so many levels. And I'd be interested, just while we're waiting for Walter to come back in, what would you think is like the thing I should be asking you?
Well, I don't know. You know, you have a certain expertise, and you know about the field. You have a PhD in it, right?
I do have a PhD in psychology. My specialization is environmental, but I was locked up in a psychiatric institution when I was 15, South Beach Psychiatric Center on Staten Island in New York, and all of my work really stems from that experience.
You know,
so
even at learning what I've learned in this field, I've been doing this now approximately 30 years. I've debated psychiatrists from Morehouse University to UC Irvine, Harvard professors. I'm astonished that they have not been able to give adequate explanations for the things that they've gone through. I'm astonished to find that this is all subjective and there's nothing objective about it, so therefore it's based on individual psychiatrists' feelings on what is going on with the person, so there's no science to it. I'm just as shocked at a lot of things that when you are researching and going deep into it, I'm shocked. And when you say what you should ask me, I'm shocked the fact that we're electroshocking people in this country, pregnant women and children from 0 to 5 years of age, with devices that have never been vetted. And it's like they just kind of grandfathered me in and you know, we need these from you, and then they never comply, and they keep on electroshocking, and then there's a law that's coming down, and it never gets enforced, and they keep on electroshocking. I mean, this field is out of control, and what I do with the groups that I'm with, through the NAACP, but more so through the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, we expose the abuses that occur in the field, and we're trying to make sure that patients do not come out of a mental institution or out of treatment worse than they were when they went in. And so we look at the fact that when I give speeches, and I give them all over the world, mainly in this country and South Africa, when I give speeches, you know, it's like there's no one who can say that my information is faulty. They nod their heads when I'm in debates. They admit that too many children are being diagnosed and overly medicated, but it doesn't change because of the money being made. So, I mean, have you gone to any of the conventions and seen where this has been addressed? Because when I debate, they say, oh, yeah, we brought it up in our convention. But then, you know, that's been going on for the last 20 years. Are you seeing any change in it or what?
I want to say a couple of things. The first thing I would say is that my mentor, who passed away recently, George Ebert, who was the coordinator of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance for nearly 50 years, would have been interrupting you saying, I was shocked. I was not shocked, to my knowledge, although there are brain waves. When I accessed my files from when I was 15, there was some test that took brain waves, but a lot of it's redacted. Anyway, I'm not affiliated with CCHR, and I usually have a disclaimer on the work that I do that I'm not affiliated with CCHR. Mm-hmm. I think that there are many people who have been trying to get to NAACP, and any entrance that and ability to connect with people who would be interested in what it is that we're trying to do, particularly through a group called Surviving Race, the intersection of disability and justice and human rights. It was really established out of the police killing and the psychiatric survivor movement wanting to support Black Lives Matter and other groups of people who are experiencing oppression, and many of the people in the psychiatric survival movement are people of color. I'm not. I'm white. I'm Italian, Irish, Jewish, Eastern European. I don't talk very publicly about this, but people don't realize it, and then it causes all kinds of troubles. When I was in growing up, when I hit puberty, it didn't work right, and my secondary sex characteristics didn't match like the failing uterus that I had. And so I was chemically mediated most of my adolescence and into my early 20s. And the first time I actually got a period on my own, I was about 20 years old. After stopping all the drugs for years. I was institutionalized when I was 15 years old. And there's not much different today than there was then. I think that we need to be talking about trauma and a variety of other kinds of issues that are spurred by these things. But in terms of the kinds of information that I stumbled over, when I got into the PhD program, I was doing a project. It was my second doc. It was called BIAS, Building Integrated Adolescent Services. And the whole idea of it was that I was going to talk with young people who were caught up in the system and have them propose what they would see as what would be meaningful for them and helpful for them in what they needed since they were there, and to help them get out, and obviously to address issues of disparities and just plain racist, classist kind of stuff. So I stumbled over, because I got to tag along with Darby Penny, who was my boss, when she brought me in at the New York State Office of Mental Health. She just recently passed away too. But when she went to see what was called the Suitcase Project, of the suitcases that were left in the attic of the Willard State Hospital that was built behind the state's first state-operated institution, the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, which is now Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center in New York. I tagged along. The archivist said that there were these journals found from the 1850s. So this is 1999. In 2005, I'm with the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance with George Ewert. We're in the middle of an 8 or 9 day fast to stop the use of electric shock treatment on children in New York State. And the state archive is across the street. So I made an appointment to go see the journals. Turns out they're 10 bound monthly printed journals called the Opal that ran from 1850 to 1860. A couple of people have mentioned this the same way a couple of people mentioned the racist ties to the institution of slavery that psychiatry has at the beginning, and they talk about Dorothea Dix and all that nonsense. But Dix was a Southern sympathizer. She's part of this story that I'm trying to tell. So anyway, when I realized that I'm on the board of directors of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, and I find out that there's a lunatics liberation movement of a journal, the Opal, that was being printed in the what is now the Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center, where the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance had an external advocacy office, 150 years later. Mm-hmm. And then, through that process, somebody gave me, and what they said was liberated, a Journal of Insanity printed in 1852, which is the American Psychiatric Association's Journal of Insanity. Today, they're American Journal of Psychiatry, back when they were the Association of Medical Superintendents of American Insane Institutions, or whatever they call themselves. Today, they're most related to NASHMED, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, because it was all the state commissioners. And so in that 1852 journal was an article called Startling Facts from the Census. And I had to, get clarification of what it was talking about, because it was so, I didn't understand. And it was basically the support of who turns out to be Edward Jarvis, I think. I can't prove it. The president of the American Statistical Association in the 1850s. I think he was the one who was writing it. but it was what established the beginning of the modern census, of taking census data at the level of the individual. Because the disturbing, and I'm sorry about the language and everything, but like they, what they said was that the high rates of idiocy and lunacy in the North was a result of the abolition of slavery. And that stopped the project bias that I was working on, and all of my attention and work has turned to this. So that was back in like 2005, 2006. And so that the APA is putting out these weeks, like the American Psychiatric Association put out that week apology like a year ago or so, maybe two, the pandemic screwed time up for me even more. And APA, the American Psychological Association, just puts out the week. it's like they literally, I haven't been able to exactly prove it yet, but I can nearly prove it, that, and what I'm talking about is the lunatics asylums in the 19th century operating in silent tandem with the prison industry, and forensic psychiatry operating inside of and supporting both systems as the 13th Amendment was established to legalize slavery as a form of punishment. And what I'm talking about is in tandem, the lunatic asylums were established complete with farms and shops, and I can prove it from the North. It comes right from Brown University. Brown University, John Brown of Rhode Island, first person held legally accountable for the slave trade. They took his ship, the Hope, away. He's the first person who sold a ship to the Navy. And then he appealed and he won and he became a legislator and then eventually like the bank and all of this other stuff. His brother, Moses, Obadiah Brown, became a Quaker. And so moral treatment, the idea of like labor is treatment, slavery.
Let me break in here. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, whenever we start talking about law enforcement, I seem to drop offline with Skype. This is really an odd thing. And this is the second time that's happened. You know what I'm saying? When you say law enforcement, something happens and we drop off.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm glad you guys were able to carry on, you know, the conversation. I just wanted to interject that in. And I'm glad you mentioned that apology, Lauren, because that's something I wanted to bring up, Reverend Shaw, from your website here. In April 2021, the APA issued a formal apology over what it calls psychiatry's role in perpetrating structural racism and history of actions that hurt Black, Indigenous, and people of color. It took them over 170 years to apologize, which the task force rejected. APA's response to Lieberman's comment was unremarkable and self-serving. Its Board of Trustees issued a statement saying it reiterates its position that both racism and sexism harm the APA as an organization, the field of psychiatry, and the people and communities we serve. Past APA presidents do not speak for or on behalf of the APA. Reverend Shaw says the APA needs to take a much stronger stand, removing Lieberman's past presidential title and issuing other sanctions. What do you have to say about that part, Reverend Shaw?
Well, I think, the thing is, if I can apologize, I can do something egregious and then apologize and never have to change my pattern, never have to change my way of thinking. All I do is stand there and apologize, then we don't ever see change. So we have to have a greater accountability. We have to have, you apologize for this structural racism. What did you do to correct it other than just voice something? Because I can go out there, rob a bank, and then tell the employees I'm sorry. And then what are they supposed to all say? Oh, well, you know, let him go. He didn't do anything. You know, he's sorry that he did. No. How do we know that Reverend Shaw will never rob a bank? We start seeing things in his behavior. We see him accept certain responsibilities. We see these things. And then we can say, hey, this is a different person. But you cannot apologize to the Black community after you said even fighting for your rights created mental illness. You know, when you stood in the door along with every other racist bigot who wanted to make sure that black people never moved forward from their condition, well, then your apology, all it is a way to say, we know we did you wrong. Come on in and get your therapy. And so we can still drug you, still shock you, still do with these things that we used to do, but we're doing it now with a smile where we just kind of had a feeling of contempt about you before then. So, you know, that's why I didn't accept the apologies and wrote articles on it, made quotes and things, because I don't see where it's made any change, and I don't see where they're trying to really benefit the black community. I see it more self-serving.
So these comments by Jeffrey Lieberman have brought international condemnation. And Reverend Shaw is a leader of the Anti-Racism Task Force. He joins calls for the APA president and Columbia University psychiatrist Jeffrey Lieberman to resign all advisory and executive positions in light of the blatant racist tweet he made. Lieberman has a controversial past, including being irrationally critical of anyone opposing his or psychiatry's works, making accusations of the type that are now being similarly directed at him, but with merit. The Columbia Vigelos College of Physicians and Surgeons wrote to leaders at four institutions affiliated with Lieberman, questioning if New York Presbyterian Hospital is safe for students and patients of color. Reverend Shaw states that, as an African-American and human rights advocate, I am appalled that Ms. Gotwick was subject to this racial abuse. Reverend Shaw calls for Lieberman's resignation from all executive and advisory positions he holds internationally, including with pharmaceutical companies. So here we have a president of the American Psychiatric Association that is in league with pharmaceutical companies, which goes hand in hand with that movie, The Hidden Enemy, that indicates that there is a conspiracy for administering these drugs that goes all the way back, you know, to the 1940s, and they're medicating service people all over the world. That movie was very good, and that it showed German soldiers, Russian, British, Navy, Marine Corps, Army, experimental drugs with Nazis. So there is a long history, according to what you're saying and according to what Lauren is saying, showing that there's a history that goes back more than 100 years of racism and also irresponsible behavior by people in the mental health capacity. Is that correct, Reverend Shaw?
That's absolutely correct. Like I was saying, that, you know, there's a history of racism from Dr. Benjamin Rush up to Mr. Lieberman, who made the statement. See, the thing that people miss is that, you know, because I've had people tell me, well, it wasn't that bad. He said it was either a work of art or a freak of nature. But the thing is, light-skinned blacks, white people, Hispanics that are light-skinned, Asian, they're not judged with modifiers. They're not, you know, it's not, I've never heard anybody say a beautiful white woman or Elizabeth Taylor or Cindy Crawford is a freak of nature. It's just who they are. But when it comes to being dark skinned, then to be beautiful is a freak of nature. Well, you know, that's not a compliment. That's a backhanded, you know, statement that is trying to come off like a compliment. But you have the hidden racism in the fact that you're judging them based on the fact that they are very dark-skinned, and she is a beautiful woman. And the reason that most people would not see her as a beautiful woman is because of this idea that the only thing, that, you know, you have to be light-skinned to be beautiful. You have to be Halle Berry or a young Jane Kennedy, or, you know, you got to be a light-skinned person to be beautiful, and dark-skinned people are not. Well, that was not created by dark-skinned people. That was created by people who preferred folks look like them. And so that's why we're looking at this issue. If you go into Africa, she made a lot of dark people look considered beautiful. But when you come to America and the European way of life, then that's held against you.
So in an email to his colleagues before he was suspended, Lieberman apologized for the tweet, describing it as racist and sexist. He added that he was deeply ashamed of his prejudices and stereotypical assumptions. So what I'm seeing is that you responded to that is that it was a public relations rhetoric. What do you mean by that, sir?
Well, you're talking about one of the top psychiatrists in America, most definitely in New York. You're talking about somebody who was over the psychiatric department at Columbia University. And then this individual is not more thoughtful than that. And where is your mental health if you're supposed to be one of the experts of the mind and you don't know not to say that? I mean, how many times have comedians been reprimanded? How many times have other public figures been reprimanded by distasteful jokes or whatever? But here's a guy at the top of the food chain in the field of mental health, and he doesn't know any better than to make a comment like that? I mean, if the reason he made it in the first place is because he was very comfortable making that statement, because he's part of an industry that believes that if your skin is at a certain darkness, which is the inception of it with Dr. Benjamin Rush, that, you know, you basically, if you're dark skin, you're not beautiful, you know, and this is the mindset that we've had in this country for the most part by brilliant men who were able to translate a racist viewpoint into the minds of the people that still, do you know that that approximately 50% of the medical students right now think that blacks have thicker skin and less sensitive nerve endings? So therefore, the painkillers that you would need when you're suffering and so forth, you don't necessarily get it because you're going to be all right anyway. Dr. Friedman, who did the lobotomies, basically said that, well, black people's families take care of each other, so therefore, you know, they're more likely to be able to be okay when their brains are destroyed by lobotomies. I mean, come on. Something is wrong here, and it's not based on any science. It's based on just what people want to believe, the trend of the time, all of that type of stuff.
So I see that the New York State Office of Mental Health, which operates the New York State Psychiatric Institute, asked Lieberman to resign as director, stating, the Office of Mental Health took immediate action after learning of Dr. Lieberman's offensive and inappropriate comments on social media. As of February 22nd, he is no longer affiliated with OMH or the state of New York, said agency spokesperson Jessica Zahn. So how often do we see people held accountable that do irresponsible things within the mental health industry? Has there been a pattern, in other words, of them just covering things up?
Mental health itself has had a pattern, but I don't want to put that on everyone in the field of mental health. I'm not against mental health. My organizations are not against mental health. We are against mental abuse, and we don't want to get the two confused. When I come at the psychiatric industry and its pharmaceutical connection, it is not to dismiss the pharmaceutical companies as bad, because they also develop the drugs that keep us alive and keep people living long after they should have maybe perished. So I'm not attacking them like that. I'm talking about the abusive side. I'm talking about when we put drugs out there on the market that do more harm than they do good, when we are drugging children with drugs that can literally cause them to drop dead, like riding your bicycle and drop dead, the drugs that can cause the suicide, many of the audiences that I've spoken to, that, hey, if you don't believe me, believe the commercials. They say the drugs can cause suicidal thoughts and actions. Well, when you hear the word and actions, that means somebody tried to kill themselves behind that drug. So that's what we're looking at. And I just want to make it clear to everybody in the audience, I want to state this publicly on your show. I'm providing a researched opinion on everything that I'm talking about. However, it is up to each individual in your audience, your listening audience, to make their own decisions based on their health. They can trust the information I have. I'll give some websites, or you can go to your doctor and you can trust him. However, I don't make your decision for you, and you got the right to make the choice that you feel is best for you and your family. So I just want to put that in there because I am not a medical doctor. However, I've been in this field researching it, stuff like that. I've began writing a book on it. So I'm doing this, but I don't want anybody to say, oh, I didn't go take my medication because of what Reverend Shaw said. You have to make that decision on your own. So I just wanted to put that out there because I don't want to put extra pressure or make anybody feel that their decision is wrong. It's their decision.
Oh, I want to just second that, and thank you for saying it. Yeah, I'm not. I also, like as I mentioned before, am not a clinical psychologist. I'm a research psychologist, but a lot of everything that I talk about is informed choice and informed consent, and that informed consent is an ongoing process. So, you know, everybody should be able to make their own decisions about whatever it is. And like anything else, look it up. It's out there. Find it.
Well, that's quite brilliant, and I'm glad that both of you are taking a balanced approach and that you're just speaking the truth, but you're not attacking the mental health industry as a whole.
Well,
not me.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well,
oh, so you are attacking.
I think you can attack the mental health industry. I mean, for me, and I know, Reverend Shaw, this is not your position, but for me, I do think that the entire apparatus needs to be brought down, to use the words of Paula Joan Kaplan, who also recently passed away. I don't want to distract from what the conversation was before about the ultimate act of Lieberman that caused his recognition and so the fact that what you were saying, somebody who is trained and who is part of this all should be able to recognize in their own behavior, but that's part of, and that adds to the issue of why the subjectivity of it is so problematic, because if they can't see it, they don't know what they're looking at. And so I think the Office of Mental Health as an entity is the oversight body of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center, where the OPAL was printed and the Journal of Insanity. You know, the Journal of Insanity was sold from the Utica State Lunatic Asylum at its Utica State Hospital existence, because all they do is change the language. It's the almshouses, then the almshouses. The poor in almshouses, where they also said that it was fine that we were on the ground without any clothing and just hay for bed and on dirt floors, chained to walls in the cellars of the almshouses because we didn't feel cold, because we weren't like them. We didn't have the same. It's just what you're saying. But and then particularly when you look at like what Vanessa Jackson's work showed in terms of shining light on drapetomania and dyschasia atypica, and those diagnoses, specifically people enslaved, come into being the same year that the Fugitive Slave Act is passed. And
so there's a long history of abuses, and then what I'm hearing is that hold on one second.
Oh, sorry.
Ms. Tenney, Dr. Tenney, you have an opposite position as Reverend Shaw. You are saying that you are attacking the mental health industry, and Reverend Shaw, you seem to be taking a more diplomatic stance in that you're just talking about research and you're talking about truths that you have discovered, you know, in the process. And I want to come back to you, Dr. Tenney. I don't want to cut you off,
I do want to just say that it's in direct relation to the modern system, because Columbia Presbyterian's Columbia University's psychiatry department is the New York State Psychiatric Institute. And I've been trying to point out that, like, first of all, why is public money going to private industries? But why is, like, in the same as the Nathan Klein Institute the OMH research. So PI is one OMH research, and Nathan Klein Institute is the other OMH research institute. And PI is with Columbia University, it's their psychiatry department, and NKI is NYU's psychiatry department.
And if I can interject real briefly here, Mr. Davis, I'm not attacking mental health. The idea of mental health is good. The psychiatric institution, as she mentions, need to be brought down. So I just want to, I'm separating psychiatry from mental health because I can't have mental health if it's all based on electroshock, psychiatric drugging of kids and children. We got something like 6.7 million children in this country on psychiatric drugs. And those drugs create time bombs because everything we see from Columbine on up through Las Vegas, Colorado, Dallas, all those people have been on psychiatric drugs. And the argument that I have, they did not kill the people before they were on those drugs. They might have been an issue. They might have been unmanageable. They might have been an irritant, but they wasn't killing people until they got on these drugs. I'm not saying this is every case the exact same. I'm talking about overall our major cases in this country have had people on those psychiatric drugs. And this goes back to Hinckley shooting President Reagan on. They was on these type of drugs and stuff. And we look at parents who are killing their children and drowning their children. And then when they're doing the research, they're finding they're on these psychiatric drugs. So we're not as far apart as you think. I just don't think that necessarily when you talk mental health, you're talking psychiatry. Because there are psychologists, there's talk therapy, there's a lot of things that we see being implemented now for veterans where they get given an animal to take care of and they found that to be effective or if they have a real purpose in life and things like that. But we got veterans getting killed, killing themselves at 20 a day, and nobody seems to think that's the issue. The issue is giving them mental health drugs when some of them are not even getting evaluated. They're just being handed the drugs. So, you know.
Can I just maybe draw on Thomas Soz for a second? Because I think that we're actually even a lot more closer than even that. Because part of what I respond to whenever I hear mental health is that we're still in a medical model analysis. And Soz, like, one of the best explanations that I had is that it's like a metaphor, that there is no real illness. It's just a metaphor. So using, like, on a spectrum of health or wellness or illness, we're still in a medical model, which then allows them to still kind of medicalize these human experiences, spiritual experiences, other kinds of things that get, like, tossed into this mix also, in addition to, like, the general racist classic ways that it gets implemented with state power and resources and great profit to industries. Right? It's still labor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there is a great distinction between the conversation here. In other words, we're not talking about the mental health industry in itself being something that's bad. We're talking specifically about psychiatry being something that's bad. The way that psychiatry is being managed in this country is inappropriate. Is that what I'm hearing you both say?
Well, I think it's also fraud, but I'll...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Go ahead, Lauren.
Oh, no, I wanted to hear what Reverend Shaw said. No, was going to say no, but it's also, it's just fraud. So it's not even, you can't, it's not even being in the dichotomy because it's like you were saying before, like there's no evidence for anything that they do or that they exist, but there's tremendous physical evidence for the damage it does. So I don't understand why their non-evidence of these things that exist is more powerful than the evidence of the damage that their supposed treatments cause. And death.
And even more, when you look at Dr. Lieberman, one of the things that upset me is he sat on a panel where people were telling how they had tried to kill themselves and everything on Prozac. It was testimony after testimony. he said right there and at the end, he said he didn't see any connection with Prozac and what was going on with these people, even though these people were telling him what was going on. Now, if the top psychiatrist in New York cannot see that when people come with a complaint and say, this is what happened when I start being on this drug, and he denies their reality, even though they actually tried to carry out their own suicides, there's something wrong with this industry. There's something wrong with him. And I want to say this. One of the reasons that I'm calling for him to be stripped of all of his connections with the pharmaceuticals and other advisory, because as fast as he resigns, it means his money comes from other sources. So these other sources, he can walk away, still have a comfortable life, still have all of this stuff, even though he was holding these types of viewpoints and everything, and these companies can continue to pay him and stuff. And the only way he suffers like the general public would suffer is if he has to go through with the general public. If I go out and molest a child, every source of revenue that I have will be destroyed. Not that, you know, it's wrong for it to be destroyed, or if a policeman kills somebody and it's determined that it's murder, then that law enforcement officer may not be able to work on any other law enforcement agency, and that's the tendency or the way that things are starting to go in law enforcement. He should have to suffer the same thing. He shouldn't have to be able to make all kind of money, giving lectures, doing all of this stuff, when he basically has these racist opinions, non-care for the public who he's supposed to be helping get treated and have a better life. So I think that it's appropriate for him to suffer like he's making other people suffer.
And that's very well said. He was getting paid $250,000 a year as part of his salary.
And bringing in $6 billion tax dollars, though. Like, OMH is not, like, they do this all the time. They use us and situations in order to try to make it look like they're being inclusive and everything else. But all they want to do is keep Hochul out of the news, because that's the only goal of the commissioner of the Office of Mental Health. I mean, they were clear about that in the 1990s, I guess it was, you know, when the commissioner came in and was like, my job is to keep OMH out of the news.
Well, see, and what's good about this show, Mr. Davis, is the fact that you got two different people who have never met, who have come to the same conclusion from totally different means, and she's a researcher, so she knows what's going on. She sees this stuff, and she's standing basically in the same spot that I am, that this is abusive behavior, this is not for the betterment of people, that, you know, this thing is subjective. It's like, and who is the agency that basically sits over mental health who's supposed to check them when they start getting far out? Why in the world would we electroshock a child from 0 to 5 years of age? Why in the world would we put 400 volts or more in the body of a pregnant woman and cause miscarriage? There's nobody in the industry smart enough to say we shouldn't be doing this?
Oh. Do you know that I have regulations, I filed regulations with the FDA against the New York State Office of Mental Health and Butler Retreat in Rhode Island? For mislabeling and misadvertising of the electric shock device. So it's allegations of regulatory misconduct. I FOIA'd the state and I got like their data and all of that kind of stuff. And there's a active, but nobody pays attention to it. So if anybody wanted to help get that word out there, because this use of electric shock during pregnancy is ludicrous. This is it's exactly what you just said. So I wanted to let you know there is I'm actively trying to do something about this.
And I'm actively doing something through the NAACP. I've had resolutions passed against the drugging, I mean, electroshocking of anyone under 21 years of age. We're now moving up to our national convention to stop electroshock, period. You know, a person like me, if I got electroshock and went through their process, I would lose possibly 1 million brain cells. But if you do that to a child, not only does the child lose those 1 million brain cells, but then they lose all of the brain cells that would have developed off of those mental, that 1 million brain cells as they grew into adults. So you're basically stifling the growth of an individual and making them a mental health patient for life. And we have to, it's been said that the cure has to be less dangerous than the disease. You know, and when we're giving people the cure, we give a person who's suicidal a drug that has a warning label that says can cause suicidal tendencies. How is that supposed to work? You know, a drug that can cause depression when you're trying to fight depression. How is that supposed to work? So we have to start looking at this, and just because somebody comes up with a paper and says this is the way it is, they have to have some investigation to determine if that is the way it is. Because just because they say it with conviction does not mean it's true.
That's it. I would love to exchange information with you and find out about those policies and what the resolutions that you're creating with NAACP. That would be really, I'm so thrilled to hear that. That's really such wonderful news.
Well, yes, and what we can do easily, because I don't want us to give our public stuff out on the phone, but Walter Davis has both of our information. He can freely give it to you on how to reach me, my website, all of that stuff, and you can do the same thing, and we can exchange it through him, and I'd be more than happy to let you have access to my website where you can see a lot of the stuff that I've done from our racism task force, and we can go from there, because I've created this task force. It's going across the nation. It's over 100 and some people, but it's all community leaders and clergy and things like that. And talk show hosts are on there, different people who have influence, so that we can get this message out and stuff, because we cannot allow people to have access to us, to be able to determine. And we have less rights in a mental institution than we do in a prison. In a prison, I can reject certain things. In a mental institution, they can go right down here to the L.A. County, get a judge, the court order, that they can electroshock me against my will. And they're doing this without ever proving that people get better through electroshock. They get quieter, but they don't get better. See, because we have a system that is actually mental control, not mental health. When a kid is hyperactive or whatever, we give him a drug to slow him down or control him. That's control. If it was mental health, he would think faster, his IQ would improve, you know, things would be much clearer. So it's not mental health. We're misrepresenting words so that we can get the idea of what we think is supposed to be happening other than what is actually happening.
Yeah, I think that there's, because it's on multiple levels, and it's social, and it's so imperative that people understand what's happening to children, to adults, to seniors. There's nobody who is to developing fetuses, shocking during pregnancy. It's horrifying as to what they do and can do.
So, like I've said in some of my talks, and I said this to a group of law enforcement officers, if the Crips and the Bloods gave the exact same drugs and the exact same electroshock in the exact same condition, we would be calling it acts of terror. But because it's coming from a field that's supposed to be trusted, then we allow it, no matter how many people's lives are destroyed, no matter how many kids die from it or kill other kids behind it, and it has to stop. If we said that those gang members were bringing in drugs that were causing kids to kill kids, they it would be a whole different response to it.
Well, I mean, Rico, right? So, like, it's such a intentional design, and there's no legitimacy to nearly anything that they're talking about. And without informed consent for any of it, it's all illegitimate. And a child's not allowed to give consent. And so even when we've tried to create avenues for young people to be able to be involved, it's been in what's happening to them in their own process and included in the process, legally they're not allowed to be involved. So that presents all kinds of other issues of rights, but the UN's special rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture has said that these things are torture. They would be a violation of the Geneva Convention, and the U.S. Supreme Court just overturned the ban on electric skin shocks like 2 months ago. So like, It's just society needs it, and this is why I say that it's so important that people understand psychiatry's involvement with the beginning establishment of the 13th Amendment, because that's how the money shifted in terms of legalized labor except as a form of punishment. And that's the industry, and psychiatry has been in the underground of it throughout the entire time, and for 40 years in their journals, debated whether or not segregated institutions were necessary to carry out the treatments for drapetomania and dysgeusia atypica, and eventually those who wanted segregation prevailed, and we've been in this system of where now people of color are more likely to be court-ordered into psychiatry. They're more likely to be forced into community programs. They're less likely to have access to programs that are voluntary. And in the prison system, it's no longer once your time is done, your time is done. Now, like in New York, for example, under the New York SAFE Act, they extended the involuntary outpatient commitment laws to anybody who had within 4 years of being in prison upon reentry into society and decarceration, you're now immediately planted into the psychiatric industry under involuntary outpatient commitment. So it's not
Would you say that again? What?
Under the New York State Act, and I FOIA'd New York State for their data. There's over 100,000 people at the time the New York SAFE Act was an extension of New York State's involuntary outpatient commitment law, but it also took away people's Second Amendment rights. I say this all the time. I'm not a gun person, but as long as it's a constitutional right, like a psychiatric history should not be able to prevent that from being met on any level. Mm-hmm. And so part of what it does is it takes away Second Amendment rights that a doctor who suspects that you might be, or a nurse or a practitioner or a teacher or anybody in the world, that was part of how New York took away gun rights in their breaking down of the elimination.
Right.
And then it also expanded the involuntary outpatient commitment law in New York, which is known as Kendra's Law, and is carried out by the New York State Office of Mental Health as a program called AOT, Assisted Outpatient Treatment, which was actually like modeled off of the DOT, the Department of Health's Delivered Observable Treatment for people who had communicable diseases. I was in the meetings. I know I was there because I was the young person and they didn't think I knew what was going on, but I did. I mean, I wish I knew what was really going on. Like, now I understand what was going on. At the time, I wish I really knew what was going on. I would have done maybe a couple of different things. But
and one of the things I want to point out to Mr. Davis is that you listen to Lauren on and what she says, how thorough she is, how well she knows her subject and stuff. And this was a young girl who was put in a mental institution. I mean, it's like, What made her,
1988.
What made her qualify for a mental institution because she thought outside the box, because she didn't conform. What was it that, see, this is what I'm talking about. You got individuals all over the world who are like her, who are very capable. At the time I was young, I could have been labeled. Thank God they didn't, because I'm 66 and they wasn't labeling as fast. But I could have been labeled because I used to get into stuff and was nonconformist and stuff like that. Now, I do admit that my parents had the cure for ADHD, but that's another subject. We used to deal with stuff later differently when I was a kid, and we were able to get through incidents. The consequences were fast and swift, and then you moved on. But the thing is that, you know, we're looking at a time, started making it where children couldn't be children. It's like, I don't know many children that went through adolescence that didn't create some kind of problem. And so we should know that's as normal as the terrible twos. You know, we're drugging and electroshocking 2 years old when they've always talked about the terrible twos, because that's when the child is actually becoming aware of being who he is and reaching out and able to maneuver his body so he can touch things and put things in the mouth. And he realized that if I cry, I can get my way, so I'll do this. But that's ever since time we've talked about the terrible twos. So why is that a mental illness? And I would ask this. Why is it if my mother, let's say my mother's killed, and I go into a deep sadness, because she's who I depend on, my father, the same thing, they're who I depend on for life, they take care of you, and you go into a deep sadness. Why is that a mental illness? What is the appropriate response supposed to be when somebody dies? Are you supposed to not cry and suck it up? Or are you supposed to cry one day? Who sets the rules on what, when it seems like that would be normal behavior?
Psychiatry does, and they just removed the bereavement clause in DSM-5. And at the same time that they made depression, with the electric shock, when the FDA was trying to downgrade it to a class 2 across the board, because it was a class 3 experimental device that was never tested for safety or efficacy, and Obama's administration said all class 3 devices needed to either be proven safe and taken off the market, safe and effective, or taken off the market. And so the device hearings, I testified at the FDA hearings in 2011 on behalf of 80 people who were survivors of shock and their family members. And it was so disgusting, and they made it so that it was a class 2 device specifically for depression or catatonia. So instead of making it for even like the rarest of situations, they broadened it to like one of the most common diagnoses. And then because they can't give the psychiatric drugs during pregnancy because of the known injuries that it causes in fetal development, they're now pushing electric shock as depression. And that they had they wouldn't let them do research to show if it was safe or effective. So what they created was what was called the sham ECT studies. And I'm convinced this is how ketamine has become the new quote-unquote antidepressant being pushed down by Insul and all those other people back. Because what they did was they told people that were getting electric shock and they just gave them the anesthetic, ketamine. Which I'm now finding is what's happening, and I found it out just by accident. But that, you know, so now they're teaching people to inject themselves with a drug that they can get on the street.
Wow. This is an amazing subject. It just goes on and on and on. And, you know, these people are supposed to be helping society, but we don't find that to be true, and anybody that truly researches it, and that's what disturbs me about Jeffrey Lieberman and stuff, these people know what's going on. They know the effect. You mean to tell me when you are seeing suicide committed by kids taking drugs that you don't get the idea that the drugs are bad? Or when you see that a person is never the same again after electroshock, why do we have to wait till a million people die before we outlaw lobotomy? I mean, it's
they didn't outlaw it.
Hmm?
They just call it neurosurgery for psychiatric disorders now. An article about it. There's an article from psychiatry about how it's important to stop calling it lobotomy and start calling it neurosurgery.
Bingo. See, so all they do is repackage old treatments and put it in a different name. You know, that is not cool at all. But anyway, go ahead.
It's totally irresponsible. And so this is what really concerns me about the way that they're now trying to take homeless people and put them into mental institutions or put them into the mental health system. I'm very concerned that people are going to be medicated, and then we're going to have people dying in mass numbers, or, you know, committing suicide or becoming homicidal, because I've seen with these drugs that people either seem to become suicidal or homicidal. You agree with that?
I do. I mean, it doesn't apply to every single case, but you know, like if you got 6.7 million children on psychiatric drugs and 1% of them will turn into a ticking time bomb that could kill other students or kill themselves, that's still a large number of people and far too great to allow these drugs to be there without being able to identify the benefit. You know, they call suicide hearing voices and seeing things a side effect. It's not a side effect, the effect. Why they call it side effect is to be able to say, oh, this is not the intended. This is what we didn't intend to do when we created this drug, but it comes with the drug. So, you know, there has to be something to make drugs far more safe and effective, or we have to get back on that couch. But let me say this. This is the reason you're not getting, unless you have a psychologist or somebody, you don't get to talk therapy. You get the drugs and so forth because I accused the top psychiatrist in Los Angeles County of drugging children with less than 7 minutes of evaluation, and he could not deny it. And he said that it's too many kids and they don't have time to counsel them, or we're drugging them, going back to the controlled behavior. But then the Department of Children and Family Services at the time asked me, how did I know that they were drugging them that fast? I said, well, the way he responded, they're drugging them faster than that. Because he went with 7 minutes real quick. So the chances are they were just talking to him and basically giving him a drug. And when I went off of a job, because there was a lot of bad stuff happening, they make you go through, if you follow workman's comp or whatever, you got to go through a site. Literally, with no exaggeration, he asked me in a very kind way what was going on. 2 to 3 minutes, I gave him the full scope. His next words were, I could prescribe you, and it was two different drugs. And I said, wait a minute, why are you prescribing me? I'm the one being abused. Why don't you give it to them? He said, I am a psychiatrist. I write prescriptions. Those are the exact words that he said. I was in there 10 minutes. They assigned me because I said, no, I want coping skills. I don't want drugs. I want you guys to help me get through this. And then so they assigned me to whoever the social worker or whoever the person was, the way you could go into the groups and talk and stuff. But it was less than 10 minutes. And two drugs he was getting ready to prescribe me.
And so what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a thing called the Medical Information Bureau report. And so this can affect your insurance rates. It can affect your life insurance. It can affect your health insurance. So if you get a prescription, that goes on the MIB.
Mm-hmm.
Were you guys aware of that?
No, I wasn't.
So I'm in the financial services business, and I have teenagers, for example, who before the Affordable Care Act came out, they were unable to get life insurance or health insurance again because they were given a very expensive drug for acne. Can you believe that?
No, can you say more about this?
Well, there is a thing called the MIB. It's the Medical Information Bureau report. It's like a credit report, but it keeps track of your health. So if you're diagnosed with cancer or if you get diabetes, it'll go on there. And if a doctor gives you a medication, that prescription is going to go on the MIB. So the insurance companies have access to that. This is how they can issue you insurance without having a medical exam, which they're doing now. They just look at the MIB. And so I've talked to people all the time. I ask them, have you checked your Medical Information Bureau report? And most people say, no, I haven't ever checked it. Well, you need to, because if somebody steals your identity, if somebody is an undocumented immigrant, for example, and they use your Social Security number and they get diagnosed with cancer, well, then you can have a cancer diagnosis on your MIB, which then will cause you to have to pay more for life insurance if you can even get it, because most life insurance companies will not give you a good rate or will not even give you a policy if you've been diagnosed with cancer within 3 years. And then they go back as far as 10 years to rate you up. They'll give you a higher rate. So what that means is that if you go to a psychiatrist and a psychiatrist gives you some type of mental health psychotropic medication, that particular prescription will be placed on your MIB, and that can then be accessed, you know, by financial institutions or the government or other, you know, people are checking you for a security clearance or what have you. They'll be able to know what your prescriptions were, and thus you can be turned down for insurance, rated up for insurance, or perhaps, you know, government offices could use that against you in the future. So I recommend that people have identity theft plans, and those identity theft plans will then notify you if something is placed on your Medical Information Bureau report.
Wow. And let me tell you something else I found. At that time when I went out on workman's comp, every drug that I didn't want to take that the doctor started to prescribe to me and stuff, not necessarily even mental health, because I've never taken mental health drugs, but the ones prescribed from a doctor. So if I had health people telling me, don't take this particular drug, and I tell the doctor I don't want that particular drug, that goes into your record. And you never seem to write it down or whatever, but that goes into your record, and then it's used against you later. And so, this, you know, the field of health, period, seems to be having an issue.
And, Lauren, you were saying something?
Oh, just how do you access that?
Yes, you can look it up. You know, MIB, Medical Information Bureau report. You can log on. There's a website. But okay, the best way to do it is to get a credit report or ID monitoring, ID theft monitoring service. Like I have one with Legal Shield, and I pay like $10 a month. And if anything gets placed on my credit report that's derogatory, or if anything goes on to my MIB that is derogatory, or if there's any changes to the MIB, they will notify me. I'll get a notice through an email and sometimes a phone call, depending upon what the severity is. But those particular services can easily access your MIB and your credit report information for you. And it's worth the $9 a month, $10 a month that I pay, you know, because I'm constantly monitoring my MIB. So I just finished going through cancer treatment in October, you know, and so the doctors wanted to give me treatments that would have caused me to grow breasts and that would have caused me to be impotent and incontinent. And it was just amazing. And yet I just told them, I said, look, if that is going to be the case, if that's what you're going to do to me, I'd rather just die. You know, I'd rather just go to Oregon and do assisted suicide before I let you do this to me. So I refused the treatment. And then I was actually advertising one of my shows that I was doing called Millionaire Mentors. And on Facebook, this thing comes up for proton radiation. And the proton radiation didn't have the bad side effects that they wanted to give me with X-ray and neutron radiation, or they wanted to do surgery on me. All of those would have resulted in the same thing. They wanted to give me hormone injections, but never offered me proton radiation at the VA hospital. I discovered proton radiation on my own, and the proton radiation does not have the same bad side effects as X-ray and neutron radiation. So the proton radiation goes into your body. It doesn't damage you when it goes into your body like X-ray and neutron radiation do, and it damages the neutron and X-ray damage everything in between the entry point and the organ that they're going for. In my case, it was the prostate. And then it comes out the other side of your body and damages everything on the other side. But proton radiation releases energy at the tumor itself, and they shape it just like the tumor. They take 14 minutes and take pictures. They radiate you for 1 minute, but then there's 14 minutes of them taking pictures of the tumor so they can shape the next beam just like the tumor. So it's very wow. remarkable. And I don't have any bad side effects. This machine they used was three stories high that they put me into, and it was a robotic arm that comes and picks you up and puts you inside of this machine. And yet this has been around for 30 years, and doctors don't tell people about it. They just bring the chemotherapy, which is going to cost you $8,000 per day, the radiation, the X-ray radiation and neutron radiation costs $700 per day. And you have to go every day for 30 days.
Wow.
And so this is very expensive. The proton radiation was even more expensive, but luckily, you know, I had good insurance that paid for it. But you're right. And I think I heard you allude to this as well, Dr. Tenney, that there is something off the track when it comes to the psychiatric industry as well as the medical industry. And so we have these things that we need, but they are based upon profit. So they're not necessarily making ethical decisions, unfortunately. They're making decisions based upon profit. It's what I see.
Profit via forced labor of taking their pills and complying with their treatments. And if it's under court order, it really is forced labor. But in general, it's labor for anybody. And just if somebody is voluntarily involved doesn't mean that the not intended effects, right, Michelle, that they won't affect them anyway. Even if you want to be taking it, it doesn't escape you from the effects of that can be injurious. And Walter, I just want to say I'm so glad that you're doing better.
Yeah, I'm cancer-free. I was lucky to be on the bleeding edge of many technologies. In fact, there's a new scan that is called a gallium-68 PCMI PET scan, and it'll scan your entire body and determine if you have any cancer cells growing in it. And it's simply amazing. It's only offered by the University of California system at the moment, but it has been FDA approved. I had to go to San Francisco to get mine done, because UCLA would not take VA insurance, believe it or not. The VA has such a terrible track record that certain hospitals will not even allow you to come there with your VA insurance. That tells you a lot about how they are treating service members. But what I recommend to people is to look at integrative medicine centers for your treatment. There you have naturopath doctors. There are new ways of treating mental illness with infrared light. Now they can insert filaments into your veins, and then they have this sensor that then goes over your skin, and it puts this infrared light into your body, and it can kill cancer, getting the radiation or the chemotherapy. I had a show on that. In fact, it's a featured show on my channel at Progress in the World here. You know, take a look at that. The doctor's name on there is Dr. Carl Felt, and he's out of Idaho, I believe. But there are many other naturopathic treatments that you can get. However, in order to have your insurance pay for these things, you need to go to an integrative medicine center that has both traditional doctors and naturopaths. And in that way, you can utilize your insurance to get access to naturopath treatments.
Well, you know, I think you might have saved a bunch of people's lives just mentioning this treatment, because only through you I've ever heard of this cancer treatment. And it's a shame that we're not using the most effective. We're using what brings the most money. And you know, and what Norman placed for what we're going through. And I'm glad just to get this. The way cancer is going nowadays, nobody knows when you will be afflicted with it. It's good to have somebody that knows something different than to go there and wait fast away. So thank you for bringing that to the table.
Well, what I can tell you is that I'm keeping track of all of these things, and I have them listed on my blog. It is holisticcentral.info. That is holistic, H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C, then another C, C-E-N-T-R-A-L.info. In fact, I will be putting that into the body of the description of this broadcast for those of you that can't write that down. Some of you may be driving or whatever, and you'll be able to go to that website and look at these different advances in healthcare, because your traditional doctors, in most cases, are not going to tell you about that. I don't think you're going to go to a psychiatrist who's going to tell you about the infrared treatments that deal with mental illness. And so one of the things that Dr. Carlfelt told me, for example, is that the yellow spectrum can be used to treat depression. And then there's a certain thing that red and green, they all have different effects. And it's simply an amazing technology now, utilizing, you know, the infrared light to treat mental illness and cancer as well. There are many different diseases that can be treated utilizing light waves now, as opposed to the damaging effect that psychotropic drugs may have on our bodies.
Wow. That's amazing.
So my mom was a nurse. My grandmother was a nurse. My brother said I was crazy. My mom said I was crazy. My wife said I was crazy. They all died from their cancer. They took the radiation. They took the chemotherapy, and they died. I'm the only one that lived. But it took me 13 years to kill all of my cancer cells. So the thing is that if you kill cancer cells quickly, the treatments also kill you quickly too. If you have the ability, you know, if you don't have a very aggressive cancer like me, if you have the time, then you can, you know, you can go about taking the treatments that I did, you know, which involved cleansing my body. You know, I'm 64 years old and I don't have gray hair and my hair is down to my shoulders. That's because I learned to clean my pineal gland with iodine every morning. I take something called detoxidine. All diseases start in the intestines. So if you clean your intestines on a regular basis, you won't be manifesting a lot of the diseases that a lot of people get. So I use bentonite and psyllium husk on a daily basis to clean my intestines, and I'm cleaning my pineal gland, and I'm using things like glutathione to fight against free radicals. Free radicals are the things that break your body down. So we're in this battle, but the doctors don't tell us. We don't have a good preventative medicine system in this country. And so when most people find out that they have diseases, it's too late, and they don't cleanse. And yet we're getting toxins in our food. We're getting toxins in our drink. So every time that you eat meat, when you eat chicken, when you eat a peach, if it has worms in it, you're getting those worms into your body. So you have to treat that with wormwood. There's something called Paratrex that kills parasites in the body. And so a lot of the diseases are being manifested by parasites in the body and by not cleansing. Think about it. You take showers every day. I guess most of us do. Hopefully most of us do. But you take a shower and you clean the outside of your body. But what about cleaning the inside of your body?
That's very interesting. You're right, clean necessarily the inside. We just eat and do what we do and keep moving.
So those toxins are building up in your body. They're collecting in your liver. They're collecting in the intestines. And some of these relate to what could be considered, you know, mental illness. I mean, because when you're feeling bad inside, right, if you've got these parasites eating the inside of your intestines, if you've got worms inside of you, you know, then you're going to be feeling sluggish. You're going to feel tired. You may feel depressed. And you may report that to one of these psychiatrists when you go in, and then they're going to put you on medication. You know, so it is interrelated. And that was a great point that you brought up, Dr. Tenney, that the medical industry, or I think you use a term something like medicalizing psychiatry, if I'm correct in making that statement. We have many different areas that we need to attack in this area, and people really need to become involved and knowledgeable, because just because somebody has a white coat on, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to, you know, that they're making the right decision. So when I went to the – go on.
I said that they're a mass murderer, like white coats, mass murderers. Lenny LaPune, I think, right, has the psychiatry's connections to eugenics. I mean, I think that we can't trust the fact that they have an authority, right, that they have that. But I just want to say, like, as you were saying that, it also can be used really dastardly. And so Tori and Jochen's whole argument that, during pregnancy, if you handle cat feces, that it will cause schizophrenia because of the toxoplasmy, whatever it is. like that, do you know what I mean? Like, and that's like Tori's whole, he even did, Tori and Jochen even did an article, so nauseating, counting, looking at the rate of schizophrenia post-World War II to see if, you know, the divine plan of killing all of those people who had been assigned psychiatric labels to test out the gas chambers during the Action T4 programs throughout Germany. And so Tori's whole, you know, Treatment Advocacy Center folks, their whole thing is that, like, that proved it wasn't genetic, so it must give evidence to his argument that it's a viral consequence for being exposed to cat feces while you're in utero. Sorry.
Ooh, that's great. quite ridiculous. And we can see this disconnect occurring when we see people like Dr. Lieberman remaining in their position year after year and you know, making racist statements and being condemned by others, yet they continue to remain in power. And it's just so irresponsible. It's sort of the same thing that we see with these police officers, right, that are being that are killing people, and then they just transfer to another police force. There is no database really that I know of that keeps track of these kinds of things. So we have a lot of work to do, and the American people need to become involved. You need to be educated. You need to do research. CCHR has an excellent list of references with regard to the falsehood of psychiatry. And a lot of the things that are happening to people, the way they're using electroshock treatment. And these electroshock treatments are not just a mild shock like you get from a 9-volt battery. These are shocks that are so intense that they can dislocate your bones. You know, your bones can come out of the socket because they hit you so hard. Now, just imagine an infant being electroshocked. That is beyond my imagination.
Well, you know, one of the things that they did under the new and improved electroshock is not they give you a paralytic drug now, because in the 50s and 60s it was his own worst enemy. People witnessing electroshock couldn't stomach it, watching people's spine snap, bones come out of joint, things like that. So now they give you a paralytic drug and anesthesia. And if you look closely, you can probably still see the trauma effect, because the feet may be slightly jerking or whatever, but it's basically to make it look more cosmetic so that people won't reject it because the people can see what the body actually went through. You have to look at the fact that right here in America, our electric, our light sockets have about 120 votes. But when you're looking at electroshock, you're talking about up to 460. So you're talking about almost four times the shock you get that most or a lot of us young boys when we were young stuck the fork into the light and got lit up. Well, it's about four times that is the power that comes from electroshock. So it's not an easy thing. It's not a good thing. And I've talked to a lot of people who have gotten it, and surprisingly the transgender community get a lot of electroshock. But the victim of electroshock the most is people over 65, which is 50% of the electroshock, and women, which are two-thirds of the electroshock. So, you know, and if you're electroshocking children, women, and old people, we used to call that a bully when we were growing up. So we're looking at an industry who thinks they know enough about the women's body to electroshock them if they respond, you know, poorly to having a baby or go through some hormonal difficulties, then we're shocking people. And one of the things I submit at a law, and at some point I'm going to be fighting for this, there will be no mental health treatment until a person has had a full physical examination. Because things like anemia can mirror depression, thyroids and urinary tract infections can mirror mental illness. You know, we don't know the difference between by looking in somebody's eyes if they have a brain tumor or if they're talking incoherently because of their mentally ill. There needs to be a thorough physical examination done before we ever start spending money on mental health, when it could be something simple that could be fixed. So that's going to be one of my next fights.
And I would go further. I mean, especially when you look at, you know, the homeless situation, for example, we should be looking at people's needs. What you said before is that if a man cannot take care of his family and he's depressed because he didn't have enough money, if you give him the money, or if he gets the money and can take care of his family, that depression goes away. So in the same token, that there should be an analysis of a person's financial situation, you know, and other things. What are the other things that are happening in their life? It could be something situational. For example, I do not believe that post-traumatic stress is a permanent condition. And yet they're medicating 98% of combat veterans, which is now translating into 22 veterans committing suicide every single day. I would also submit that we need to be evaluating the medical establishment just as well. And we need to start holding people accountable. I wanted to also touch on
Before you go on, I just wanted to let you know, particularly the issues that veterans may be experiencing. I did FOIA the Veterans Administration for their electric shock data, and every veteran in this country, I published an article about this on Mad in America back 5 years ago or so, every VAMC, Veterans Administration Medical Center in this country, owns an electric shock device, and they only count when they've shocked somebody twice or more. So there is literally no telling of how many people have been subjected to electric shock once through VAMCs in the country. But when you look at the very high correlation between suicide and electric shock, it's another issue of concern. The VA is also using electric shock on people who are pregnant, and also the military sexual trauma. And I would just like to say, like, if it's something like early childhood trauma or childhood trauma or domestic violence or intimate partner violence or some kind of sexual or psychological or physical assault that somebody may be surviving, that kind of, like, it can be decades that there's still I can't tell you how often I say, like, I'm going to be 50 years old. I can't believe shit from when I'm seven and still hanging me up. So, like, there is, but there's also differences also. So, yes, the medicalization and the nonsense of the way that they are, they're human rights violations. It's an atrocity that they're allowed to do this to people who serve this country or anybody. But that is happening at this other level of non-oversight of, like, who watches the watchers, who's watching the state, because then it's the federal government. And the federal government at the level of SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, or the larger VA, they don't, how can you sue somebody who says that it's their standard practice? That's how they hide behind it all, because it's the acceptable practice. So when we're talking about neglect or misprescribing or any of these kinds of things, because it's within the canons of the industry, that's why the industry needs to be taken down. But sorry, I'll stop now. Thank you.
But keep in mind that when you go into the military, you have to sign documents saying you will not sue the U.S. government. So veterans can't sue the U.S. government because of some type of maltreatment. You never heard of anyone suing, although everyone seems to know about the horrible service that we're getting. I wanted to touch on something that you were both elaborating about women's bodies. What is the fixation on the genitals? I mean, if you look at the word hysterectomy, I believe that comes from saying that a woman is hysterical, right? So they take out her insides. Am I being correct when I make that statement? Is that what they're doing?
Well, I mean, I could say from a Freudian analysis of it, Freud's first theory was seduction theory. He was brought in to consult on issues of quote-unquote hysteria as a neurologist, and what he said was that there was no biological, neurological thing that was causing these things that were being pushed together as hysteria. Instead, it was a consequence of having been sexually assaulted. And that through talk therapy, through talking about the assault, they were able to heal. That was his first theory. That was the basis of psychoanalysis. It wasn't very popular, so he rewrote it as what we all know now as psychosexual development, where in the phallic stage from 3 to 6 years old, children are sexually attracted to their parents. And what was happening was that these adult patients were having fantasies about having sex with their parents when they were children.
And Reverend Shaw, I saw that at the museum when I went through there, that they had these electroshock devices that they would attach to a man's testicles, and send shocks through the testicles. I mean, what is this fixation on genitalia? I don't get it.
Well, it's like she said originally, that came out of Freud, that that basically our dreams and our sexual repressions were the cause of our problems. And the thing is, sometimes, and I'm going to quote an old sergeant of mine when I was on the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He said, sometimes people are sicker than we are well. And, you know, to try to make sense out of that kind of treatment, it makes sense like, the dunking of people in cold water and ice water and leaving them under in containers that could cause their death. So when you look at this field, you got people just scratching all over the surface who use whatever the media, public medium of the time to push forward ideas that, like I said, even though you say them with conviction, doesn't mean they're true. And so we found out very few things have actually worked in the field of mental health because they have never gotten down to the problem. I'm going to give you something that I did as a minister, two different things real quickly. One, when I owned group homes for boys, we had a boy that was totally anti-authority. He would rebel. He'd want to fight the adults, but he controlled himself to some degree, but he hated anybody in authority. Now, this kid was put on medication, wouldn't take it. He was going through everything. Nothing's wrong with me. I know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. One day, me and him went into a room. I locked the door, and we just stayed in there and talked. And when it was over, he was crying. I was crying, everything. Let me tell you what his problem was. He's a kid whose mother was a deaf mute, who somebody hooked on crack cocaine. So she got so addicted that she started working the street. Sometimes they would park the car by where he went to school, and when the kids would see the cars parked, ease over and look to see what was going on, because they knew that she was doing these acts and she couldn't hear the children or anything, you know, because she was doing the act. Well, then kids can be very cruel. So then they come back, your mama just did this, your mama, and he would fight them. And then he would get in trouble for fighting. Now, me and this kid was in there. We deal with this. And let me tell you what changed his life. All I said, I really want to apologize to you that nobody, no adult, I said, in your environment was smart enough to know that you were just trying to protect your mother. And that kid cried and cried and cried. But when he came out of it, he was a different person. All that happened is I acknowledged what he was trying to do. Because when I grew up in these, when you talked about somebody's mother, those were fighting words. So, you know, I basically, all the treatment, therapy, the drugs, they want to put him on, got handled just with an acknowledgement. So it's like, you know, we can sit here and say something's wrong with the kid, but we can also say we didn't have the ability to handle the kid. The second one was done right in the museum where the psychiatric museum is. Nurses came through. One of the nurses talked about the fact that her son had been killed. She had went on Prozac. She seems to not be able to get over it. And I sat there as a minister and talked about life, death, and the spirit. Everybody in the room, all her classmates was there. I just started lecturing on it. And she started smiling. And she got the idea that her son would be okay no matter what. And it changed her right there in front of her own classmates. They were shaking their head in disbelief. Nobody had been able to talk. She just had to know that even though he passed, in her mind, he was okay. Now, I didn't get paid for none of that. People baked into the therapist, how did I handle it? And I've never been trained in the field of psychiatry. So this is what sometimes, if you just can give a person solution to their problem, his problem wasn't his fighting. His problem was he was trying to protect his mother. And no adult could think past punishment. That was all that kid. That's all that woman needed, was somebody to tell her spiritually her son would be all right. So I don't know what these guys are doing, that they can't come to those conclusions.
And so, unfortunately, the VA is phasing out talk therapy, and they're giving something called cognitive therapy. So you're supposed to read a book, and that's supposed to help you get over your PTS or your depression, anxiety, whatever the thing is. And it's simply amazing. If you call the VA mental health offices and you talk to them about talk therapy, well, they're going to ask you, what is that? They don't even know what it is. They're not even training these people now in terms of what talk therapy is. And that's what I was trying to say earlier when I dropped off. I spoke to a doctor of psychology about how shame is the number one thing that people drink over to medicate shame. And shame is a state of being. It means I am wrong. You know, what is wrong with me? Whereas guilt, and we use those words interchangeably, guilt is action. I did something wrong, or I didn't do something I was supposed to do. And you know, this psychologist laughed at me and said, oh, yeah, right, I'm just going to drink because I feel ashamed of myself. He just tried to invalidate me. And yet he didn't understand that people medicate emotions with these chemicals. And so in the talk therapy sessions, as you said, Reverend Shaw, I've been able to talk to people and found out that their situation was simply because they were mixed race. You know, I talked to a young Asian man who was just very angry and disgruntled. He'd gotten a DUI. He had a drinking problem. And I found out that he was bicultural. He didn't fit into the Asian community. He was Korean and white, and he didn't fit into the white community either. So when I was able to talk to him about the four different types of people in a culture, there's four different kinds of people. There's the acculturated person. They don't like being black or white or Latino or whatever they are. There's a bicultural or multicultural person. They like to interracially marry. They have people at their house, at their church of different cultures, and they associate with them. The acculturated people, by the way, also adopt the physical characteristics of another culture. So in other words, straightening your hair is an acculturated behavior. It doesn't mean that it's right or wrong, or putting curls in your hair when it's straight to make it is an acculturated behavior, or suntan lotion or bleaching cream on your skin to make your skin brighter. And then there's the third category is people that want to separate. And those people are called culturally immersed. And that's two flavors. There's a violent, they're called, the deviants are violent. Culturally immersed deviant are violent people. They do things like maybe KKK, maybe the Tamils in India, PLO, Irish Republican Army. And then you have people that do constructive things, and it's just for their culture. Maybe some parts of NAACP could be like this, La Raza, or maybe some far-right Republican Party-type people could be in this category. And then the last category are traditionals. They just see themselves as American or Italian. You know, you don't call them white. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps there is a black man in lower Alabama somewhere that never has traveled more than 25 miles from where he was born, or a white guy in Montana that hadn't traveled very far, hadn't really interacted with other races. Those people don't see themselves as any particular kind of race. They see themselves as just being American or Canadian or whatever their nationality is. So I was able to help this young man by just talking to him and helping him accept himself as he was. That didn't require any drugs. So just like you said, Reverend Shaw, there's a benefit in talk therapy. So what are they doing? Why are they medicating people to get these negative results? Why are they using electroshock treatment? Why are the American people allowing this to happen? You know, we all see it. I just can't understand the complacency that we're allowing veterans to be mistreated this way, that women are being mistreated this way, and that we're allowing these perverts to run the psychiatric industry as it is, and they're doing a great deal of harm to our society. So I just want to encourage all the listeners, please educate yourselves. Go out here and look. Look at the things that are happening. Any responses from the two of you on that?
Well, one of the things I can say is that they can, if they really want to know the subject and they want to get more information, they should go to cchrint.org. We have a drug database. You can put your drug information in there and find out what the effects that drug can cause to you. We have a whole 3D tour of the psychiatric museum there, campaigns like the Fight for Children campaigns, things like that, that you can read about, or they can go to cchrtaskforce.org. And this is all of the stuff I've done on the subject. And my reply, like the article you read and the statements are on that, and people can go there. The only thing that's going to benefit the people is that they educate themselves in the subject. Otherwise, they will continue to believe the rhetoric that they hear on the television. They will continue to believe the commercials, even the commercials. When you look at the amount of pharmaceutical commercials on television, the networks can't even afford to pull or even criticize medicine or psychiatry or whatever. These drugs, if you just pay attention to the commercial, you got a drug that my regular drug did not work as efficiently as my doctor thought. So now they add another drug. And then when that drug won't work, then you'll find we found that the combination of this drug, that drug, and the other drug will cure you 90%. Where did that 90% come from? I don't know, because none of us who've ever researched it and stuff found it, but they make the statements and things. So we have to educate ourselves. We have to make sure we know the solution and do not depend on the media to give you your solutions when those solutions may be very well tainted by the people who pay them, just like the FDA. When you research it, you'll find a large percentage of FDA people work for the pharmaceutical companies. Therefore, everybody knows you don't bite the hand that feeds you. So therefore, the FDA doesn't always work on our behalf. Now, there are some drugs that maybe do, but these psychiatric drugs shouldn't be on the market, and they wouldn't be if it wasn't these guys working for the companies themselves. So it's just, you know, it's a lot to it. It takes a little bit of work to really know what's going on, but they tell you these things are incurable. My son, the reason I got into this fight is my son was diagnosed with dyslexia. They told me dyslexia wasn't curable. I'm a kid that came out of the street, and I'm an ex-law enforcement officer. I always have asked questions. So they come to me, and they want my son to see a psychiatrist. And I said, for what? To help him with his self-esteem. I said, I'm his father. That's my job. That's not mental health job. That's my job to help my son with his self-esteem. Well, it comes down to it. A friend of mine told me about a place I took my kid to. They worked with him. They had him doing his letters in clay. They had him doing all kind of stuff. He wanted to quit. I told him, just hang in there a little bit more for me. Just do it for me. And he hung in there. One day he comes over and said, Dad, I don't think it happened anymore. I know all my numbers, my letters. Well, what happened to incurable? So I said, if this is not curable, and I'm looking at, I'm not hearing about or reading about somebody else's kid, but my son is saying he's better. I called the school, said, hey, I had him under private therapist. They want him retested, and they couldn't find where he had dyslexia. So then I asked, just part of my nature, well, who else is being diagnosed with certain types of diseases that could be fixed? And maybe it's just that the school, I wasn't even looking at mental health at that time, maybe the school just didn't know how to handle him. Because to this day, he's not suffering the effects of it. So it's like, wait a minute. Well, you, if I didn't have a friend who's still a mentor to my day, and I hope God keeps extending his life, if I didn't have that friend, I would have never known. And at some point, I may have caved in to all of this. But as it is now, you're talking about 30 years later. He's not having any problems from it, or 35 years later. So we just got to be educated and know what's going on.
Very well said. We're down to our last 6 minutes, believe it or not. Dr. Tenney, you want to go ahead and give a plug for your show and make any final statements now? We got only 6 minutes left.
Oh, sure. I'm currently working on a documentary. It's called Mental American Monster, The Sprawl of American Psychiatry. I'm not affiliated with anybody. and so my website is lauriantenney.us. But I was really honored and really happy to be involved and invited to have a chapter in a book that was just published by Routledge that was edited by Craig Nunes. It's called Racism in Psychology, Challenging Theory, Practice, and Institutions. And my chapter was specifically around calling for and looking at the ways that what I talked about earlier in terms of psychiatry's involvement with the establishment of the system of slavery, but really looking at how, you know, over the last 175, 180 years particularly, that rooted intentional design of the psychiatric system to strong arm the state because the state was now giving them money to run their asylums has implanted in our way of a way where modern psychiatric services are being carried out in racist and classist and gendered ways in New York State and throughout the country. Laws like what are infamously known as like Kendra's Law or the Baker's Act or the Marchman Act or any of these kinds of laws that particularly go after groups, including I'm noticing more and more veterans and former police who are coming in and talking about post-traumatic stress and then are being subjected to court-ordered psychiatry and having their Second Amendments taken away from them and all these kinds of things. So I think that the issues around restraint, solitary confinement, drugging, electroshock, aversive behavioral interventions, the skin shocks that have just been overruled, there are so many pressing issues that people really have to just come to understand that this is not a benevolent association or industry that is supporting people. People's crises are real. Experiencing and lived experience of oppression is real, and those things need to be outrooted. Childhood trauma is real. Those things need to be outrooted and people can heal. But when we're talking about it ultimately as a form of social control, where the government and state are growing their reach at the same time that the industries are profiting and the people who are actually caught in it all are experiencing torture and other types of human rights violations, not limited to slavery and murder. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk. I do have a Blog Talk Radio show on Talk with Kenny if anybody wants to come in. And I'm currently seeking anyone who wants to be interviewed as part of the documentary to contact me. So thank you so much.
And what is your documentary about again, briefly?
Oh, it's the 19th century. So it all stems with that journal article that I found that from the 1852 Journal of Insanity that supported the system of slavery, and then links into like the establishment of psychiatry's involvement with the establishment of the 13th Amendment, legalizing slavery as a form of punishment, both inside of the prison system industry complex and in silent tandem with the lunatic asylums, where labor became the form of treatment. And then eventually that moved into and through a system of developing segregated systems and then the move into eugenics and psychiatry. So the stories, all seven stories, stem from the Utica State Lunatic Asylum. And I really believe it's not only that they changed the story of psychiatry, but it changes the history of America in that process. So the Utica Asylum sold the Journal of Insanity to the American Psychiatric in 1921, and that's today's American Journal of Psychiatry, published by the American Psychiatric Association. So,
okay, well, I'm very honored and to have the two of you on board. I really appreciate your inputs, Reverend Shaw. You're excellent as usual, and we'll continue this series. This is the third in the series of shows that we have done. Be sure to listen to our other shows, Killology, as well as the Electroshock series that we did earlier. And I just really appreciate the two of you and the work that you're doing. I really admire you, and I'm here to support you in any way that I can. Please look for a link to Lauren's show and her website, Dr. Tenney's show. I'll be placing that in the body of the description of this broadcast, as well as the links to CCHR. Please go aboard that site and take a look at the references on there. They're excellent. And you can take a look as well for a much more extensive description of this show on my website at walterdavisglobalbroadcasting.com. This show was sponsored by my financial services company, which is WealthWave. So visit wealthwave.com/WalterDavis. We teach people how money works. We show you about annuities, retirement plans, and you can get a free $500 value financial needs assessment that we can help you get on the right track and make sure you have a plan for your retirement in the future. I really appreciate all of you. Please share this broadcast with your family, friends, and constituents via social media. I really appreciate all of you that are listening at this time. I am leaving you with Black September by Lazy Batuzu, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.